You're listening to WBTV LP Burlington, Vermont, broadcasting at 99.3 FM and streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. This is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro. Today on Write the Book, you'll hear an interview with Vermont author Adam Fetterman. And then in the second hour of the show, I will air an interview from the archives with the poet Claire Rossini. Adam Fetterman is a reporting fellow with the Investigative Fund at the Nation Institute, covering energy and the environment. He has written for The Nation magazine, The Guardian, Columbia Journalism Review, Gastronomica, Petit Propos Culinaire, Earth Island Journal, Adirondack Life, and other publications, including, I believe, Vermont Digger. He's been a Russia Fulbright Fellow, a Middlebury Fellow in Environmental Journalism, and the recipient of a Polk Grant for Investigative Reporting. A former line cook, bread baker, and pastry chef, he lives in Vermont. For more than 30 years, Patience Gray, author of the celebrated cookbook Honey from a Weed, lived in a remote area of Puglia in southernmost Italy. She lived without electricity, modern plumbing, or a telephone, grew much of her own food, and gathered and ate wild plants alongside her neighbors in this economically impoverished region. She was fond of saying that she wrote only for herself and her friends, yet her reputation Her growing reputation brought a steady stream of international visitors to her door. This simple and isolated life she chose for herself may help explain her relative obscurity when compared to the other great food writers of her time, M.F.K. Fisher, Elizabeth David, and Julia Child. So it is not surprising that when Gray died in 2005, the BBC described her as an almost forgotten culinary star. Yet her influence, particularly among chefs and other food writers, has had a lasting and profound effect on the way we view and celebrate good food and regional cuisines. Gray's prescience was unrivaled. She wrote about what today we would call the slow food movement, from foraging to eating locally, long before it became part of the cultural mainstream. Imagine if Michael Pollan or Barbara Kingsolver had spent several decades living among Italian, Greek, and Catalan peasants, recording their recipes and the significance of food and food gathering to their way of life. Feasting and feasting, biographer Adam Fetterman tells the remarkable and until now untold life story of Patience Gray, from her privileged and intellectual upbringing in England, to her trials as a single mother during World War II, to her career working as a designer, editor, translator, and author, and describing her travels and culinary adventures in later years. A fascinating and spirited woman, Patience Gray was very much a part of her times, but very clearly ahead of them. Early in the book, Adam Fetterman writes that Patience Gray remains little known beyond a small circle of food writers and critics. And so when I spoke to him, I began by asking him to talk about why Patience is not better known. I hope you enjoy listening.
Right. I mean, that was really one of the main factors that motivated me to learn more about Patience was this kind of paradox in the fact that she'd written this book that was lauded as one of the great food books of the 20th century.
Right.
And yet, you know, most people, including myself, had never heard of her. You know, I didn't know who she was until after she died in 2005. And, you know, there are, I think, a number of factors that explain why that's the case. One, the kind of life that she lived, far off the beaten path, literally, you know, disconnected from, you know, sort of the mainstream publishing world. She and her partner, Norman Moments, who was a sculptor, they traveled beginning in the 1960s throughout the Mediterranean and eventually settled in the south of Italy in Puglia, where they lived without electricity, telephone, or modern plumbing. So they were, you know, they were out there on the margins. Mm-hmm. And Patience never really wanted to, I think, conform to the conventions of the publishing world that perhaps she felt would have been necessary to be better known. You know, she, at the same time, she didn't publish a lot of books like some of her contemporaries, like Elizabeth David, M.F.K. Fisher. So she is really known for this remarkable book that she published in 1986, Honey from a Weed.
Yeah.
And at that point, you know, she was almost 70 when that book was published. And, you know, it made its mark, but Patience herself never really came into the fore.
Right. Yeah. Now the book Honey from a Weed, it's part recipe book, part travelogue, part memoir. And in reading about it, it struck me that it's very much like a contemporary creative nonfiction collection, you know, which will kind of pull together different components to make a really interesting collection. So she's ahead of her time in that way, too, you know, creatively.
Yes. I mean, she really did combine a number of genres into a single book.
Yeah.
You know, even the table of contents is divided into two columns. One is sort of essays and reflections on the places that they lived, and the other column is sort of organized around the various kinds of foods and dishes that she learned. And at the same time, it's a kind of an encyclopedia of edible wild foods. So she brought together many threads and. You know, I think that does set the book apart. And, you know, it's a good observation that kind of mixing of genres and forms is something that's only really become commonplace, you know, more recently.
Yeah, yeah. Now, is that book still in, is it being reprinted or anything? Or
It is. Honey from a Weed, in fact, has never gone out of print, and there's been a great deal of interest in it since the biography came out. So Prospect Books still publishes it. They originally published it in 1986.
Okay.
And as far as I know, you can still get it from them. However, there may be a bit of a backlog at this point.
Yeah. And did she ever write updated editions or anything?
You know, no, it was never updated. There were a number of different editions. There was an American edition in 1987. Harper and Row published almost immediately. And in fact, it's kind of interesting. It sold. It didn't sell well here, but it was. Its critical reception was quite enthusiastic, and a number of American food writers raved about the book. And several of them actually made the journey to Puglia to meet this woman. So it did. You know, it had this appeal to, you know, food writers like Corby Kummer, Ed Baer, John Thorne, Harold McGee, Alice Waters. I mean, the list goes on.
Right.
But the book itself, you know, it just didn't, for some reason, reach a very wide audience. So, yeah. You know, it's great now to see it being rediscovered.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, you first learned of Patience Gray when you ran across her obituary after she died. I'm wondering if you can talk a little bit about how that initial introduction grew into this project.
Yeah, so that was back in 2005, quite some time ago. I came across an obituary in The Art of Eating magazine, which is published here in Vermont by a guy named Ed Baer.
Uh-huh.
And Ed was a great champion of Patience's work and was one of those food writers who had gone to visit her in the 1990s a couple of times, and always maintained that Honey from a Weed was one of the best books that will ever be written about food.
Yeah.
And I think that line is in that obituary. And I, you know, I remember being quite struck by that fact, and you know, never having heard of Patience, you know, who was this woman? Who was this writer who's so highly praised? And then it turned out that my parents actually had a copy of Honey from a Weed that I'd never noticed.
It had
been given
funny.
To them by an anarchist friend many years ago. And so I was, you know, I was immediately taken in by the book and the prose and just sort of it's kind of a spellbinding book, you know, both in its presentation and in the contents of it. So I was really hooked from then on. And I had no idea that I would end up writing a biography, but that marked the beginning of my sort of interest in her and research about her life.
Yeah, I think that personal connection, you know, first of all, running across something interesting and then finding it in your parents' kitchen, that culmination would really kind of come together to make something really interesting.
Absolutely, yeah.
I remember when I was when I was young, and still I have this friend whose grandmother was a very influential Chinese cook, and she sort of introduced Chinese cooking to America. And I remember sort of thinking, yeah. And then when I was first dating the man who became my husband, I found her cookbook in his kitchen, and I'm like, oh my God, Grace Chu. It's like, this really was a real thing.
Right.
Yeah. Okay. Anyway, now Patience's father was a Jew, but he suppressed his Jewish ancestry and he took a new name to sort of improve his chances in the military, in his career. Mm. And you write about how this and other aspects of Patience's sort of English upbringing and a lot of suppression of information affected her. You write in the book, she would say to people, why were we always being conjured to tell the truth when they were concealing it? And I think that you make a good case that affected her in ways that changed how she lived her life. So I wonder if we can talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, you know, she wrote a memoir that was published in 2000 called Work Adventures, Childhood Dreams, and there is a section on childhood. And, you know, she was often, she was very critical of what she felt was the hypocrisy of her parents' generation in the Edwardian era in England, which sort of covered up a lot of the elements of life that patients felt were important, life and death and sexuality and things that patients in her memoir describes as being, forbidden subjects during her childhood. Mm-hmm. And of course, her own father's identity was wrapped up in that. His father was a Hebrew scholar from Poland, and his grandfather had actually been a rabbi. So he ended up, as you said, changing his name from Varshavsky to Stanham, which was Patience's mother's last name. So there were all these layers of obfuscation, and Patience, you know, she resisted that, and also resisted the conventions of family life from quite an early age, and was also lucky to have the opportunity to study in London at Queen's College as a young woman. She traveled quite a bit and then went on to the London School of Economics and had opportunities that her two sisters never had. So on the one hand, you know, she was very dismissive, I think, of her parents, but also in a way never really acknowledged the fact that they did help to facilitate her own kind of intellectual, you know, journey.
Right.
But you know, that idea of childhood being suffused with hypocrisy was something that Patience held on to, you know, throughout the rest of her life, and it was almost like she couldn't let go of that fact.
Yeah. Do you think that is part of the reason that most of her relationships seem to be with married men?
You know, that's a very difficult question to get to the bottom of. I mean, she definitely had many, you know, I would say most of her close relationships were with men. She tended to keep other women sort of at arm's length. And you know, some of her close friends described her as being a very jealous person. But you know, I don't know entirely where that sort of comes from. I mean, she did, of course, have a very difficult and decisive experience during the war when she had two children out of wedlock and then left. So the father of her children was a man named Thomas Gray, and she took his name, but never married him, and left him in 1943, and essentially raised her children on her own after that. And, you know, was always just a very independent person, you know, sort of living her life on her own terms. So.
Right, yeah. Yeah, and I don't mean to be criticizing her choices. It's just interesting that if she, at a very young age, rejected the conventions of family, then maybe that's why she didn't really respect or choose to recognize other, you know, because wasn't Thomas married to another woman? And
right. Yeah. I mean, I think without a doubt, she was looked askance at sort of the bourgeois, you know, conventions of family life, you know, and never really cultivated that kind of life for herself. I mean, she did eventually marry Norman, but that right. was many years later. I mean, it's a really interesting question, and I think, you know, it does get to a very important part of Patience's personality, which was this idea, this sense that she had of herself as an outsider.
Yeah. Another little tiny tidbit that you drop in there that I thought was interesting is she loved secrets, dark corners, and mysteries, and she was drawn to astrology and mysticism. How did you run across that? Was that through meeting her friends or her children telling you that, or?
It was a combination. You know, it's an interesting thread, and it's not something that I explore in a great deal of depth in the book, but I do think it is her interest in mysticism and astrology in particular, and Norman too, was very, had studied these things for years, and his father was a theosophist, and they definitely dabbled in a lot of kind of alternative psychology and philosophy, and you know had a kind of utopian worldview to some extent, which I thought was interesting in Patience's case, because she was also very much very knowledgeable about the natural world and something of an ethnobotanist. I think she became an expert on the science and uses of edible wild plants, but that, you know, coexisted with this interest in astrology and spirituality, and you know, perhaps they're not, you know, mutually exclusive.
Yeah, I mean, she was thinking outside the box in every aspect of her life, right?
Yeah, she was. And she also had a real, you know, innate curiosity and didn't, at least intellectually, didn't rule anything out. But the sort of secretive aspect, that was certainly something that people talked about frequently. You know, she was a very private person. And that quote that you just read is from a friend of hers who they met when they were living in Puglia. And Patience had her own studio there, which she loved and rarely admitted people, rarely showed other people. And there's the story that she kept a large black snake in her studio.
Yeah.
So there was always this sort of sense of that she occupied some other kind of plane, I guess.
Yeah. Well, let's talk a little bit. You're just mentioning that you had interviews with friends, and I know you spent quite a bit of time at her son's place. So researching her life must have been fascinating and a lot of fun. I wondered, how many trips did you make tracking down resources and interviews and things like that?
Yeah, there were many. You know, the first trip I made to Puglia. So Patience and Norman had lived, as I said, in the far south of Italy for more than 30 years. And toward the end of Patience's life, after Norman had died, her son Nicholas and his wife Maggie Armstrong traveled down there to help take care of Patience. And they have stayed on at the masseria or farmhouse, which is where a lot of Patience's letters and writing and also Norman's work remain. So they're, you know, they've helped to kind of archive everything that was left behind. And I made my first trip there in 2006 in the fall. And, of course, after that, in researching the book, went back a handful of times and also spent time in London, both interviewing friends and family and visiting various archives. In addition to that, there were a handful of people in France, in Paris, and a couple of other places who had known Patience when she was, in the 1950s or 1960s. So there was a lot of tracking people down, tracking letters down, and piecing together that earlier story.
And did she keep journals as well?
She really didn't. I found a few journals that were, you know, maybe started, you know, sporadically, but it wasn't something she did regularly. Really, her form of journal writing was letters.
Yeah.
You know, she wrote on an almost daily basis, and that's part of what made this project so fascinating, is that there was this vast archive of letters going back to the late 1930s.
Yeah, isn't that interesting? I wonder, in the future, you know, are people going to be like following trails of emails, or because it feels like that's a lost art, the letter writer.
Yeah, I think it may be. And these letters stand out for many reasons. Many of them are illustrated with watercolor drawings of plants or images that patients felt were particularly compelling. So you really get a sense of who she was through her letters.
Yeah.
And, you know, she was a great writer, too. So, yeah, I mean, I think certainly emails can't really compare to that kind of writing.
No, and certainly not getting the personal feel for a person's handwriting and pictures and everything.
Exactly.
You mentioned she was a wonderful writer. She had a career as a journalist, and she was the first editor of the Observer's then new women's page, writing about art, design, food, and philosophy. And she used her column as a reason for traveling throughout Europe. And then ultimately she felt that writing about art was a poor substitute for making it. And I thought that was an interesting moment in her life. I thought it must have been a very difficult decision for a professional woman to make in the 50s when it was so hard to be a professional woman to leave that behind.
Right. Yeah. And not only that, but she had just published, you know, one of the best-selling cookbooks of the 1950s, Plat du Jour, which was published in 1957.
Right.
By Penguin, and was, you know, widely celebrated and sold very well. And right after that, she got this position at the Observer, where she worked for the next 4 years. So, you know, she undoubtedly could have continued on as a journalist and food writer, cookbook author. But at the same time, in 1958, she meets Norman Momans, who would become, you know, the great love of her life. And Norman was an artist, a very creative spirit, and he really encouraged patients to pursue other, you know, ways of approaching the world. And you know, patients really did feel that it was more valuable to devote your time to making something, to whatever that may be, than you know, just writing about what other people were doing. And she had done that for so long that she started at that time to really feel like, you know, it's time to pursue other things. And with Norman, she was able to do that.
Yeah.
And of course, in 1962, they left London. And that was really marked, that marked the beginning of their, you know, their Mediterranean odyssey, as patients call it.
Yeah. Now, before we move very far past it, you mentioned her cookbook that came out in 57. And I'm wondering, is there any link in your mind between, there was a huge profusion of cookbooks that came out in the 50s and 60s, including, you know, very famous Julia Child's cookbook. And I'm just wondering, do you think that had to do with the sort of like focus on returning to conventional values after the war, or is there anything that you think prompted that?
Well, it's such an interesting period. I think that is part of it. You know, the post-war period was so full of possibility. You know, you have to consider the fact that rationing, especially in the UK, had been in place for well over a decade. Mm-hmm. So there were real restrictions on what people could access and use in their cooking. So after the war, even before rationing had been lifted, Elizabeth David's cookbooks created this kind of you know, tantalizing picture of what the Mediterranean world was like and what cooking could really be. And as you say, at the same time, you know, the war was over. A lot of women who had been engaged in wartime work were back sort of in the domestic sphere. Certainly not all women. There were more and more women who were working, and including patients. But I do think that there was to some extent an emphasis on kind of getting back to basics in terms of, you know, homemaking and that kind of thing. But you know, food became a way of and food writing, especially for these women, Elizabeth David and, you know, M.F.K. Fisher here in the United States, was a way of writing about so many other things. And you know, I find it just a really fascinating period.
Yeah.
Just going to jump in and let you know you're listening to Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. This is an interview with Vermont author Adam Fetterman. And if you're enjoying this show and this conversation about his new book, Fasting and Feasting, please consider liking it on Facebook, liking the book, but also liking the show, rating it in iTunes, or tweeting about Write the Book. Thank you so much. Stay tuned for the rest of the interview.
Have you made the recipes in Honey from a Weed?
I've cooked some of them. I mean, it's funny. I have to admit that, you know, I've been researching her for so long, but I've actually cooked from Honey from a Weed very, very little. It is the kind of book that you tend to read and not cook from, but that's not because the recipes aren't good or approachable. I mean, they really are. And they're just wonderful sections on all kinds of things, from soups and legumes and beans to, you know, fungi and edible plants.
Yeah.
I mean, I've done a handful, but it really is a book worth exploring.
Yeah. And then, have you experienced in some way the very complicated recipe for the Feast of the Three Fishermen of Calafell? That sounded awesome.
it's an astonishing description of a real feast. I mean, it actually comes from a book that Patience's dear friend Irving Davis had compiled and that Patience edited and published after his death in 1969. It was called, Catalan Cookery Book, a book of impossible recipes or something like that. and the Feast of the Three Fishermen, I mean, it begins with this amazing line that's something like, you know, first take a plane to Barcelona, you know, find your, you know, drive to the coast, find your fishermen and set out for the day. So it's not the kind of dish you're going to prepare at home. But, you know, then she goes on to describe it's composed of like three or four dishes, all involving, you know, these various Mediterranean rockfish and of course aioli and gallons of wine. And it's one of the lovely feasts and celebrations of food that punctuate, you know, her book.
Yeah.
And, you know, that was one of the things, you know, she often wrote about scarcity, or, you know, that was part of the dichotomy, and the title of my book is related to that, Fasting and Feasting, but Patience certainly loved to celebrate food as well.
The Feast of the Three Fishermen. It's funny, I really should have looked through this before I made this comment, because I haven't looked at it in years, but are you familiar with a cookbook by Salvador Dali?
I don't know it, but
very
strange. I'm trying to imagine what it might be.
It's very strange.
Yeah.
Okay. Actually, while we're at it, you mentioned your title, and I wanted to talk a little bit about the title of your book and also the title Honey from a Weed. Can you just sort of explain those two?
Yeah. So for years, in fact, Fasting and Feasting was the working title for Patience's book. She had actually finished a draft in early 1970, right around the time that they moved to Puglia.
Mm-hmm.
And it would take her almost 15 years to find a publisher. So that gives you a sense of just how kind of unconventional the book is.
Yeah.
Even though most people recognized how remarkable it was, they just felt no one would ever, no one would go for it. So the title Fasting and Feasting, you know, and the idea of sort of abundance and scarcity was something that Patience felt was really central to Mediterranean cooking. And her publisher, Alan Davidson, had sort of discouraged her from using that title because I think it had appeared as the title of another book recently. So he felt that they should try for something else. And really, right up until very close to the publication of the book, they were still kind of mulling over what the title might be. And that was, I think, early 1986. The line from a William Cowper poem, "They whom truth and wisdom lead may gather honey from a weed," something like that's where Honey from a Weed came from that poem. And it really just kind of captured, I think, what Patience felt was, was something that had driven her for years, was this idea that plants and what we sometimes think of as objects that aren't really worthy of our attention really do hold this beauty. So the title, I think, even though she had been kind of holding on to fasting and feasting for years, Honey from a Weed immediately became the top choice, and that's what her book was titled.
Do you know who found the poem? Did she find the poem, or did he?
I think Norman actually stumbled. Her Norman Moments, her partner, stumbled upon it. They had a collection of Cowper's poems, and okay. I think Cowper was he was fairly well known among their generation, and was often quoted. So it was one of those coincidences that came up in the course of the book.
Yeah. Now let's talk a little bit about Patience and Norman's approach to life. She was a locavore who loved to forage for foods and cook with wild foods available locally. And how much do you think that has contributed to our modern focus on these approaches? Or do you just think that she was sort of a forerunner to these movements and now we can look back and learn from her?
I think she was living that kind of life and taking a very serious interest in wild foods long before it had become, popular. That's without question. But it was a function of where they were living and the people they lived among. Patients learned from peasant women and children, for the most part, how to identify plants and weeds when they lived on the island of Naxos, almost on a daily basis. Mm-hmm. Women would gather wild plants and bring them to the village tap and wash them, and patients learned their names and how to use them. And throughout the 1960s, wherever they lived, she continued to learn from local people. So it wasn't something that, it wasn't a hobby for patients, but I do think that her comparative approach, she was writing about these plants both, in the Italian landscape, but also Catalonia, in Greece. So the book is really quite remarkable for that. And I do think that, there's a lot of interest today in local foods and in wild food, but I think patients really kind of took it to another level and really focused on the kind of cultural backdrop for these plants and mushrooms, yeah, and whatever else she was gathering.
Right. And, to the extent that it's now a phenomenon in our modern society, it's sort of contained to restaurants and farmers, and we make decisions about where we're going to go for our farmers' share and crops, mm-hmm, like that. But we're not in our backyards usually, not most citizens, looking for food.
Right. And I think the big difference is that the places that patients normally were living, it was still part of the way of life. It was something that people did regularly. So, yeah. That's something that's really faded away from modern society. And it's not as if Patience was writing about something that was new. I mean, she was really writing about, an older way of life, way of being. And I think that's part of what made her book so appealing.
Now, before they went to Italy, you just mentioned this a minute ago, they lived for a year on the island of Naxos in Greece. And just, this is just a small moment in the book, but the journey itself sounded sort of grueling. I mean, they packed up a truck and they drove and they stopped on the way visiting friends and stuff. And then they eventually got on a ferry and they had to get to Naxos. And then they're like on this like rocky path trying to find signs of life. It was really intimidating.
Yes. I mean, I really wanted to give a sense of just how arduous the journey was, because it's not like it is today. And they had this old army lorry truck, and they packed up whatever they could. Norman had his carving tools, and Patience her jewelry making tools and writing material. She was working on a cookbook at that time.
And it, you know, it was a many days long journey just to get to, you know, the Greek mainland. And then from there, this 18-hour ferry ride, and, you know, they get deposited on this little island in the Aegean. And, you know, it was by far the most remote place that they lived and worked. And I think it had a profound impact on their outlook.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, they continued to live simply, but they didn't stay there.
That's right. Yeah. Actually, Patience wrote a very interesting book about their experience on Naxos called Ring Doves and Snakes. And she wrote it in the mid-1960s, right after their time there, but it was only published after the success of Honey from a Weed, and it's now out of print. So that was one of the, you know, Patience was always writing, but most of her books were not published during her lifetime.
Yeah. Now, the other popular movement that I thought of while I was reading the book is voluntary simplicity. Mm-hmm. And Patience and Norman chose to live very simply when they got to Italy and earlier. And they were, like, basically off the grid and in rural areas. So I just wondered if you can talk. You do write about World War II and the Blitz and how this affected them, that they chose to live this way. I wonder if we could talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, well, certainly in Patience's case, as I mentioned before, living in this cottage, it belonged to her mother, Olive. In West Sussex, so pretty rural England. She's there with her two children. There's no electricity. The water comes from a well. She rarely sees a newspaper. No radio. And relatively isolated. And you know, during the war, of course, rationing and blackouts, and obviously just the constant fear and threat of bombardment. So, you know, a really challenging moment. And Patience did start then to actually forage and use some of the local plants and mushrooms in her own cooking. But I think that the way that necessity forces you to, you know, make do with what's at hand, that was something that Patience certainly never forgot. And Norman, I think they were both searching for a different, you know, different way of living. You know, they wanted to escape the what they felt was the patients called it, you know, the descent into consumer land, just kind of the suffocating you know, elements of modern urban society. So fleeing London, and then they spend many years looking for the right place that would allow them to have the kind of creative life that they wanted. And you know, I do think that they did entertain the possibility of creating their own kind of artistic you know, commune, for lack of a better word. But it never really came to fruition. And I think that they did ultimately find a way to live the kind of simple life that they wanted.
Yeah. And another aspect of their outlook was environmentalism. And do you mind if I read just a paragraph from the book?
Please do. Not at all.
So this is from the mid-80s. By the mid-80s, as Honey from a Weed was being revised, Patience and Norman had become increasingly preoccupied with environmental issues. Norman kept boxes and boxes full of press cuttings on ecological problems and devoted particular attention to genetically modified foods and nuclear power. I mean, that's amazing. I mean, he's just thinking of this stuff really right at the very beginning of, I guess, sort of a larger public understanding of what's changing. Do you agree?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, they were very aware of changes taking place in agriculture and in the landscape right around them. You know, there was a proposal to build a nuclear power plant nearby that never happened, but it was something that they became quite active in opposing. And they
subscribed to environmental magazines, Resurgence and The Ecologist, and they were very much paying attention to what was happening, you know, even though they were, you know, many, many miles away and in, you know, in some ways cut off from the rest of the world.
Yeah.
You know, and it was something that they continued to follow, you know.
Now, that was after Chernobyl, right?
Chernobyl happened, in fact, when Patience was working on Honey from a Weed in April 1986, I think. The book came out just a few months later. And it was an interesting moment because Patience certainly mentioned it in her letters to her publisher. And he said something like, doesn't all of this, you know, work on food and cooking seem rather trivial in the context of this kind of calamity? So she struggled with that to some extent in terms of, you know, how much of a cookbook do you devote to discussing the kind of the grim reality of you know, ecological devastation.
Yeah. Okay. Adam, I wanted to just shift gears a little bit and ask you what you have read, what you are reading these days that you find interesting and might recommend to listeners.
You know, as we were discussing earlier, I've really been interested in the post-war period and the kind of food writing that came out of it. So I've been recently reading a number of memoirs from that time, trying to get a better sense of what it was like to live through that period.
Right.
And you know, my other work involves environmental reporting, so I've been, you know, following things happening in that world as well.
Mm-hmm. Any books that might appeal to a lay reader that would be of interest?
The book that I'm in the middle of right now is actually called The 50th Mystique, and it's a really wonderful memoir. That's quite intriguing.
Okay, and talk a little bit about your next writing project.
Right. Well, I'm trying to figure that out at the moment. You know, I would really like to do a book on the post-war period, on the food writing in the 1950s, looking at the lives and work of these mostly women writers, Elizabeth David, M.F.K. Fisher, Patience Gray, you know, Alice B. Toklas. I mean, they just produced what I think are some of the great sort of food books, literary kind of cookbooks of any period, and in many ways transformed the genre into something that was taken seriously. And I think that historical period hasn't really been looked at through that lens. So if I'm able to do a book on that subject, I would love to.
Oh, that sounds great. I usually finish up these interviews, Adam, by asking for a little bit of advice for writers, because my listeners are writers. And I thought in your case, I might ask a little bit about, as a biographer in this case, recognizing a subject about which your passion will carry you through years of work involved, and also from the perspective of a journalist and biographer, knowing, like, you had so much resource material to work through, and knowing what to use and what to cut as you undertake a project, you know. So I wonder if you can speak to either or both of those a little bit.
Yeah, you know, it's such an important question. And it's sort of like when, you know, knowing when to stop gathering material, when to stop writing, it's kind of an elusive thing. But you know, and of course, this is my first book, so I didn't go into it with any sort of systematic method or framework. But I guess what I would say is that the most important thing for me was crafting a story. You know, I wanted it to be a book that people, you know, would read. You know, and not a reference work. So I feel like thinking about it that way helped me pick and choose what, you know, what to include and you know, what maybe to leave out.
Right.
It was really the narrative and the story that I wanted to carry the
the facts and other material along, because we inevitably with biography, you are going to be dealing with a lot of information and facts and details and names, but you really have to leaven it, and let the story, sort of tell itself.
Yeah, that's, I would think too, you have some beautiful sections of photographs in the book, and I would think that helps a little bit because you can put in a photograph of one of the drawings in one of her letters, for example, and that gives information about the sorts of science she was thinking about when she was looking at these plants, but you don't have to go into great detail about every single one.
That's right. No, the photos were lovely. And, you know, the family helped me out tremendously. I was very lucky in that way. To have had access to the kind of source material that I did, you know, that was really, 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 obviously it's the foundation of the book, and without it, you know, it wouldn't have happened.
They must be very pleased with the book.
I think so. I think they're quite happy. You know, the grandchildren have somewhat different opinions, and their relationship with their grandmother, with patients, was challenging. So, it's certainly been, it's been very interesting to see the different kinds of reactions from friends and family, and then of course from people who had never heard of patients before.
Yeah, I think it's so cool that this book exists and we can learn more about her now, and of course that her book Honey from a Weed still exists, so people can start to look back and learn about her more.
That's right. Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah.
Well, I'm just going to mention again that the name of the book is Fasting and Feasting, The Life of Visionary Food Writer Patience Gray, written by Adam Fetterman and published by Chelsea Green right here in Vermont. So, Adam, I want to thank you so much for speaking with me today.
Thank you. It was a lot of fun.
This is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. That was an interview with Vermont author Adam Fetterman. We discussed his new book, Fasting and Feasting, The Life of Visionary Food Writer Patience Gray, published by Chelsea Green. You can learn more about his work at his website, adamfetterman.com, and also on the website of the publisher, chelseagreen.com, and then if you go to /fasting-and-feasting, or you can just search for his name, Fetterman, on the Chelsea Green website. Also, the book that Adam recommended when we had our conversation was The 50s Mystique, and that is written by Jessica Mann. So this week's Write the Book prompt is inspired by the interview you heard today with Adam Fetterman. The prompt is, look for inspiration in a cookbook. So, for example, in my kitchen, I do have the cookbook I mentioned to Adam, the cookbook by Salvador Dali, which is actually titled Le Dîner de Gala. And in opening the book, I find many things. I find recipes like lobster with black pearls and ramekins of frog's legs and tripe of yesteryear and lots of drawings and photographs and weirdness. You know, maybe you'll open a more tame cookbook and find an inscription from a friend that maybe reminds you of a long ago birthday or anniversary, or maybe you'll be inspired by a photograph of a lamb chop with mint jelly, or, you know, maybe a recipe for turkey with Roquefort, and that would inspire you maybe to write about a family celebrating Thanksgiving in France, and why are they there, and what happens. Whatever you find, let it be the way into your writing this week. Good luck with your work in the coming week, and please listen next week for another prompt or suggestion. If you're interested in sharing this show with out-of-town friends, let them know that archived episodes of Write the Book are available on iTunes and at writethebook.podbean.com as free podcasts. And you can visit Write the Book on Twitter and on Facebook for updates. You can also access the podcast at my own website, shelaughswithoutus.com. If you have a guest to suggest or comments about the show or news about book-related events, please send an email to writethebook@gmail.com. If you like the show, please rate it in iTunes, like it on Facebook, and tell all your friends. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro, and you've been listening to Write the Book. This is 99.3 FM, WBTV LP, Burlington, Vermont. Streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. Have a great week.